Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future.
Stay tuned for a chat with Douglas Rushkoff, one of the leading media critics and cyberculture experts of our age. Speaking today with Douglas Rushkoff. Douglas Rushkoff is the author of 8 best-selling books on new media and popular culture, including Siberia, Media Virus, Playing the Future, Coercion, Why We Listen to What They Say, and the novels Ecstasy Club and Exit Strategy. And most recently, Nothing Sacred, The Truth About Judaism. He has a graphic novel forthcoming from Disinfo, our friends who we've interviewed before. His books have been translated into many languages. His commentaries appear on CBS and NPR. He has a monthly column on cyberculture from the New York Times, and he has a blog at rushkoff.com. He's a very wide-ranging, multimedia kind of content producer for our information society. He has an award-winning frontline documentary, The Merchants of Cool, and I'm very, very happy to have him with us. He also teaches at New York University's telecommunications program and is an advisor to the UN, lives in New York City. Welcome, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hi, good to be with you.
So you're exactly the kind of person for a Change Surfer Radio audience, and we're very happy to have you. But the precipitating event for me inviting you on was an essay that you published recently with Demos, the UK think tank, on open source democracy. And I think we'll come back to the rest of your oeuvre because it does seem to have a number of connections to the other things that you've worked on. But let's start with your opening chapter in Open Source Democracy is the demystification of our political storytelling. What is the mystifying nature of the story that we tell ourselves about our political and cultural reality?
Well, I mean, I suppose the biggest myth is that there's some meaning to all this. You know, the idea that we're put here with purpose, that there's sort of a pre-existing rationale for human activity that we're supposed to somehow take on faith. I think what people are waking up to, and you know, one way or another, I mean, largely as a result of their ability to create their own media and tell their own stories, is the fact that the story isn't really written yet. Whether it's the political story or the capitalist myth or the communist myth or even the Christian myth, that these are not predestined. That actually, you know, we are writing the human story. And this is, you know, this is the realization that people seem to get every couple of thousand years. They go, oh, you know, it hasn't all been preordained. We're actually participating. You know, that's what the Judeo-Christian, you know, movement was about until it got, you know, calcified into a predetermined story. That's what the Enlightenment was about and the American Constitution until, you know, the Constitution came to mean some sort of calcified code of laws rather than a system through which we can create laws. You know, even democracy has become really equated with some kind of, you know, free market capitalist rule set rather than a process through which people, you know, deem to govern themselves. So really what I'm looking at is how do people, well, first have the ability to deconstruct or demystify these stories and then ultimately gain the ability to write them themselves. So it's really moving, you know, past disillusionment and even past postmodernism into a new and perhaps somewhat naive and idealistic, but new roles as creators.
You say you're moving past postmodernism, but it seems like a lot of the discourse that you're using does come out of a postmodernist critique of meta-narratives and unifying historical narratives. And one of those unifying historical narratives is the kind of progress of democracy, that we're becoming an increasingly participatory society. So it seems like, you know, on the one hand, you're trying to move past that, but on the other hand, there is a kind of narrative of progress in what you're saying, that we may be at the point now where we could have a more fully participatory and decentralized society.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly there's a narrative implicit in what I'm talking about. I would just my hope is that it's a narrative that might have an alternative structure than the narrative we've been using. You know, I think we've been using this sort of Aristotle coined it, you know, this is Aristotelian narrative, the sort of, you know, very male orgasm curve arc of, you know, you work really hard, you reach a crisis, and then you have your climax, ideally, you know, your utopian endpoint. And what that tends to do is to make people ache towards completion, ache towards conclusion and certainty. And the kinds of narratives that I'm hoping can replace it are narratives that aren't quite so dependent on finality and certainty. You know, perhaps a more a narrative more in line with the notion of emergence, that rather than having to start with meaning and a track to complete and an endpoint to get to, that we see, you know, meaning and logic and purpose kind of emerging from human activity rather than, you know, being used to justify it.
What are some of the signs that you think you see in our contemporary society? And again, you've written several books about this already. Playing in the Future was about youth and kids who are plugged into digital culture, and Siberia was about cyberculture as well. So out of these explorations that you've done, what are some of the signs of new civil community or new political organization that you think are emerging from electronic communication that may be the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, some of them are the most obvious ones, you know, kind of working backwards from, you know, political blogs and MoveOn.org and homemade commercials and alternative media, you know, from alternate to adbusters. You know, we see people on the first level sort of deconstructing the style and content of commercial media, but then graduating to a point where they actually, you know, develop their own media, do their own, you know, reporting, their own analysis, and their own judgment. You know, so you're, you know, as likely to be, you know, online reading, you know, a blog by a disgruntled 16-year-old kid as you are, you know, the BBC or the CNN online. You know, not just because it's entertaining, but because, you know, that kid might say something. You know, it was a college student, actually an ex-student of mine, who helped bring down, you know, Trent Lott after his misspoke at a party. But you know, it's sort of the end point. The kinds of stuff I wrote about before was everything from, you know, fantasy role-playing games to kids developing fractal programs, to going to raves, to making electronic music, to you know, having, you know, wild visions, some of them of their own, developing their own community, to going out online for the first time and creating bulletin boards and Usenet groups. That, you know, what I was seeing from the late 80s on were the possibilities for collaborative storytelling, for a collaborative narrative, whether it's doing it as entertainment in a fictional space or whether it's translating that over to reality and saying, you know, well, what kind of world do we want to build together? Do we have the means to do that? So what I've been doing is really throwing this idea up against pretty much every institution I can find that calls itself developmental or evolutionary. You know, I threw it up against Judaism to see how Jews would react, because, you know, Judaism really is the branch of thought that, as far as I can tell, that founded this philosophy of a sort of an evolutionary civilization rather than an ordained one. And sadly, each place I've thrown the idea, for the most part, has rejected it, because the institutions that have come up, you know, by this time are pretty well invested in the way they see things. So while Judaism, for example, might have been invented to dispel the notion of, you know, a single idea of God, or to dispel the notion of nation of you know, divinely ordained nation state, now Jewish institutions seem dedicated to preserving this notion or to creating that notion, or where, Democratic parties, may have been originally created to give voice to people and to allow for genuine participation in civic affairs. Now they're much more about following a charismatic leader towards a very, entrenched set of policies. So it's kind of funny. On the one hand, I have hope because everywhere I look, I can see this sensibility both in the original ideas of these, largely Enlightenment institutions, but emerging sentiments in, if not everyone, at least the younger and more active members of these communities. So while they may get, ultimately, the Democratic Party will reject the notion of open source democracy, on the other hand, you've got, a guy like, Howard Dean, if not creating an open source democratic campaign, at least exploiting some of the principles of an open source media space to get people more involved in the democratic process.
Well, there is a tension between movement building for a more liberal society, I think, and then just saying go forth and prosper. And I live in that tension a little bit myself because I'm an activist, I think, for a more liberal society. And you can't just say, go forth and prosper. You want to say, follow me to the new Zion, and the new Zion is going to be a more liberal place.
I think the latter strategy ends up failing in the long run. In other words, follow me to this new great ending generally just raises people's expectations for a revolution of some kind that ends up going in a circle. And rather than just saying, let them have their cake, or let's go forth and prosper, I think, there's a maybe a more nuanced way of saying that, which is more, rather than having a revolution, let's just begin the world we want to live in right now. It's great. This guy Žižek from Slovenia talks about that too, where he doesn't use the same language I do, which is that of, Renaissance versus revolution. But he's saying, rather than having a revolution working towards something, let's declare the revolution won. Let's decide that we've already won the thing, and all we're doing is making the world now a more just place. We're just waiting for it to trickle out. And it might be a useful model to try on so that we don't see ourselves so long-term, cause-oriented, up the hill, but we realize, no, we're going to have to make slow, incremental, and sometimes boring steps to make the world a better place.
Oh, I'm definitely down with that. I describe myself as in the tradition of 400 years of the liberal democratic movement. I'm speaking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's a media critic at NYU, the author of many books and a film about the way that kids are manipulated to buy capitalist stuff called The Merchants of Cool. And I want to touch on that for a second because there seems to be a theme through several of your works about coercion and media manipulation. You've written a book called Coercion. You've written Media Virus, The Hidden Agendas in Popular Culture. And you've written a book about Stoned Free, about the effects of non-drug ways of changing our consciousness. Let me ask you this. This is a little bit off the topic of open source democracy, but it seems to be one of your themes. You're concerned about the ways that that mimetic control may influence us. Have you thought about ways that technology and some of these information technologies or other technologies may be used to free ourselves from mimetic control, that that we may have avenues in the future of being more conscious of mimetic, of how we're being targeted mimetically?
Yeah, well, different media have different biases. And that's sort of what interests me about them. It's that the media space really has never been a truly level playing field. Those with size advantage might have had a unfair advantage in the past. Those with economic advantage can end up with a definite advantage on the media scape. There are moments, usually moments of transition between one medium and the next, when there's kind of a bit of a free-for-all. We saw that at the very beginning of the Internet age when, kids and some pretty wild people seemed to understand how that landscape worked better than corporate America. You know, so Joe Hacker was better off than Rupert Murdoch in spreading ideas and sharing his own ideas on the internet. And then we saw, you know, the pendulum kind of swung the other way as the internet kind of morphed into the World Wide Web, which was a much more static medium, you know, much more presentational. There was much less room for conversation and banter back and forth. But then as business fell away, we saw even the World Wide Web become more operational. It really became a lot more like the early internet, where people put bulletin boards over the World Wide Web and conversation areas on top of it. So it's almost as if now, when I look at it, the internet seems once again as functional as it was in 1993 or 94, which is a positive sign as far as I'm concerned. So I think that, you know, the more people's hands are on the keyboards and off the mouse or off the remote control on the TV, you know, the more that they're actually engaged in conversation, buffeted hopefully by facts, I think the better off we are. There's been a few rhetorical backsteps in the last few years too, though, which is this idea, I guess perpetrated mostly by, you know, Fox News or the O'Reilly Report, that everyone's entitled to his opinion and all opinions have on some level equal weight. So it's kind of this crossfire-like way of using television. And the problem with crossfire, I mean, you can go to sort of Marx's critique of Hegel for this, really, is that two opinions arguing it out don't necessarily reflect any of the facts.
There's a classic critique of that point of view about how on CNN you can get a debate between someone who wants to legalize slavery and someone who doesn't want to legalize slavery, instead of about, you know, further four kinds of racial progress or legalize cannibalism versus regulated cannibalism or something.
And right.
Although the terms of the debate themselves are restricted. But
right. There's this fantasy in American journalism that if you create balance, then you've somehow, you know, now you're creating truly neutral, fact-based news. But it's wherever you draw the fulcrum is going to decide the balance of the actual piece.
I thought about that a lot the other night. I was on the other side of the mic the other night being interviewed by Alan Combs, who's the, quote, liberal side of Combs and Hannity. But, you know, I just can't take seriously the notion of any kind of balance on Combs and Hannity. Even if you go to their website, all of the links are to the right. You know, there's no left page and right page on the webpage.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking with Douglas Rushkoff. He's a wide-ranging media critic, teaches at NYU, and has many, many books out. Some of your books have been about youth culture and raves, and you had this book about digital youth. And tell us what you thought you found with when you looked at the lives of young people engaged with digital culture. Because when I see my son glued to the, you know, my 8-9-year-old son glued to the computer, or my daughter watching the videos off of the MTV website that she can't get here at home, I get a little anxious about it sometimes.
Well, we can't help but be anxious about it, particularly when we don't understand exactly what's going on in there. I mean, you know, as media people, we're a little better off than the majority of American parents who just look at this as another world that they know nothing about. I mean, what I was trying to do in that book and in a lot of my work about youth culture, you know, without being, you know, totally sanguine about it, was to let parents know and adults of all shapes know that there's something more complex going on here than meets the eye. You know, this work started when, for me, you know, when parents and teachers and government officials, you know, wanted to ban Beavis and Butthead because they thought that a show like that actually, you know, makes kids want to start fires. You know, what they couldn't see in this kind of media was the fact that kids were actually getting a good dose of media theory along with this. You know, Beavis and Butthead and shows like it really do inoculate kids from the spell of mainstream media. The reason why these things are truly so threatening to, you know, the powers that be is not that they're pornographic or teaching kids violence. It's that they're teaching kids how television works. They're commenting on it, whether it's, you know, South Park or Mystery Science Theater or any of these shows that are kind of media about media. I mean, even The Simpsons, in the first, you know, 4 or 5 years it was out, was considered, you know, a dangerous and radical show because it didn't really have standard story structure. It was more a media satire than it was a typical sitcom story, and people couldn't understand quite what it was doing. I mean, what it was doing was launching the sort of the Generation X ethos to mainstream culture, and doing it in a kind of delightfully insidious way.
Fascinating, and it's actually very good that we had this discussion because my wife's going to listen to this afternoon, and we were just arguing about whether my daughter should be listening to Pink or not. So I'm hoping that your arguments will have some sway in our household now.
It depends the way, you know, what ultimately it depends how she's listening to Pink. You know, it's the same thing. It's like it depends how they're reading the Bible. It depends how they're watching the news. You know, any one of these media can be, you know, a force for education and insight, or a force for, you know, further indoctrination and passivity. You know, it really has to do with understanding that this is, you know, a human being expressing him or herself, you know, in the way that they see fit. It is not necessarily, you know, the way things are.
Cornel West said it's not whether you require the canon, it's how you read the canon.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let me bring you back to network democracy for a second, though, because at the end of the book, you mentioned a couple specific policies of things that you think might be implemented that might look a little bit more like an open source democracy or a decentralized democracy. And you mentioned local currencies, which have been an idea fix for many people in cyber culture, the notion that electronic currency might undermine the nation state and lead to various kinds of anarchy, and also energy grid decentralization, people plugging into the grid. And in both of those cases, I think the flip side argument is how reliable and predictable would decentralized production be? I mean, how much would a local currency weather rapid inflation or deflation or economic change? I mean, you need a central bank to have some of the kinds of control over economy that people want. And I think that this is one of the meta challenges to your perspective, that there are still functions that only a centralized state can provide.
Yeah, I don't know that it's an either or, though. I mean, I look at local currencies as complementary to national currencies. So, you know, as we develop it seems like we're moving towards a fewer regional currencies. Like, I could see all of North America being on the dollar, all of Europe being on the euro, you know, all of Asia being on something. It feels like we're moving towards that. But as we move towards, you know, tighter control over our national currencies, I think we can also have a variety of local complementary currencies, which are superior for certain kinds of purposes. You know, they are something that can allow a municipality or a local region to actually create or to leverage the advantage of supporting local merchants. You know, it allows a kid to do babysitting and to get currency that they can buy records with without involving the tremendous premium on cash that you know, Alan Greenspan's money costs us. So while, you know, for Walmart to get, you know, 10 million gizmos from China, we certainly would want them to use a national currency. For me to get my car fixed by the local mechanic, well, yeah, maybe the parts I'm going to buy with U.S. currency, but maybe the labor I'm going to pay for with local currency that ends up getting fed back into the community in a different way.
We only have a couple more minutes left, and so you have so many different topics that we could delve into. But another one of the articles I read of yours recently was called The Networked Individual. I'm immersed in the transhumanist subculture around the country, and one of the debates that frequently appears in our subculture is about the nature of identity as people undergo the many transmutations that transhumanists imagine will soon be our condition. And you seem to be talking about that in our kind of current situation, cell phones and all the ways that we're currently networked. How do you think, will the individual, the concept of individuality itself and of individual separateness begin to undergo further mutation as we become more networked. Is that the idea behind your piece?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, what we've been struggling with, I mean, really since civilization began, is how do we balance our sense of ourselves and our wills as individuals with our sense of ourselves as part of a collective, you know. And since we moved from the sort of tribal, or what Walter Ong would call oral cultures, to the literate visual abstract cultures, we've had a real hard time with this separateness thing. It's as if we can understand ourselves as individuals, or we can understand ourselves as part of some great universal organism, but we don't think that there's room for both. In other words, it's some kind of an either or. And I think that's because we are still steeped in the kinds of philosophies that were born in the Renaissance. You know, the Renaissance is what really gave birth to the notion of the individual, and then the Enlightenment is what pushed the idea of individual rights. And this was a great thing, especially, you know, in a world that was becoming increasingly centralized. But it's perpetuated the illusion of a Renaissance individual, of a person, you know, alone in their suburban home, you know, with the power to be independent and free, as being the ultimate satisfactions for a human being. And I think what we're learning is that they're not at all, that they're actually, it's an extremely alienated state, that there's no such thing as self-sufficiency, in part because there's no such thing as the self. You know, the self does not exist except in relationship to other people. So I think as we are able to let one image of the individual forged in the Renaissance to become more and more porous, as we become more confident in the nature of our existence as something that transcends individual boundary, we will actually become more capable of redefining ourselves through our connections to other people rather than our boundaries from them.
Doug, I'm going to have you back another time, because you're just you're full of ideas. And the books are available online. There are 8 best-selling books. His columns and blog are at rushkoff.com. I've been speaking with Douglas Rushkoff. He teaches at NYU, has commentaries on NPR, CBS, in the New York Times. You'll probably see him all over the place now that you're alerted to his existence. And so thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.